everyone, and welcome back to the Courage Conversation Show. I'm your host, Ashley Easter. I am the founder and executive director of Courage 365, and we have a great show planned for you today. We are going to be interviewing an ex-Jehovah's Witness. Her name is Wendy Renee, and I met her probably about 6 months ago. And we've talked on the phone a couple times. I've heard a bit about her story, and just she is truly one of those prolific people that is just out there changing the world. I knew we had to bring her onto the podcast. And whether you are ex-JW and coming maybe through Wendy's audience, or whether you are a longtime fan of Courage 365, we welcome you here. Courage 365 is all about supporting survivors of any type of abuse, but we often talk about religious contexts where it happened in. And before I introduce and bring Wendy onto the show, I just want to read a quick bio for you. Wendy Renee, after 37 years of experience in a high-control religion, Jehovah's Witnesses, she is a survivor of intense mind control and indoctrination. It was that wisdom and experience that helps Wendy help other people. Wendy is a vocal advocate for survivors of high-control religious groups. She's a podcaster and a writer. And Wendy, I just want to welcome you onto the show. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me here. With that intro, wow, thank you very much.
Absolutely. It's all true. I've really been excited by our interactions and just the impact you have made. I noticed that there's a lot of similarities between ex-high control group survivors, but often we're siloed into our different ex-communities. But I love when we can come together and have conversations because there are so many similarities. And I think the wisdom that you had to share after being in a high control religion for 37 years, it's a long time. You have a lot of experience and super excited to talk with you today. And I guess what I really want to start with is, would you be able to give us, and I know this is a hard question, but like the nutshell version of your story being in the JW, Jehovah's Witness community, what that was like for you, and then what brought you to a point where you decided to leave?
You're right. That is a very sometimes difficult question to ask, but I've had some time to contemplate that. So you're right. Jehovah's Witnesses is a high control group, and even though the nuances between the religions are different, they're pretty much the same. They're out of the same playbook. So Jehovah's Witnesses is no different in that they baptize young, they indoctrinate young, some are born in. My experience was that my mother brought us in when I was about 9 years old, maybe a little younger. I was baptized into the religion at 10. And child baptism is something I'm a big advocate against because no child should be making decisions that impact their life. Especially baptism is they say it's more important than marriage. That's what Jehovah's Witnesses talk about. So if you're baptized and you do commit wrongdoing, according to the religion's doctrine, you're kicked out and you have to go before three men and confess everything. And they're able to determine whether or not you are allowed to stay in the religion and have your friends and family, or like they determine your repentance. In my case, but
before you move on, I just want to make sure I'm understanding this. So little children are being baptized, and with that baptism comes this commitment to the rules that they have. And if you don't follow the rules because you're baptized, they can then insert some type of punishment, which could be disconnection from your community. Am I understanding that right?
Absolutely. Now, wow. Outwardly, they say we don't baptize children, that people make a choice of their own volition. But Ashley, we all know that when we are given a certain amount of choices, or when we're convinced or indoctrinated under coercion, whatever terminology we choose to use, we think we're making the right decision because we're children. That's what we do, what our parents are encouraging us to make these decisions. So they'll hold that choice against you as you develop, as you get older. And every Jehovah's Witness knows if I'm baptized, I have to watch my step because I could end up in that back room. And I've been in that back room about three times in my life. It's especially as a single woman, it was not. I think that's the most traumatic experience that if I can remember. I was disfellowshipped. I was kicked out. And it's like watching what your life would be like if you died. You, one moment you have everyone, your friends, your family, your whole social structure. And then just they make a big public announcement. And then nobody talks to you. Nobody looks at you. Nobody. And I lived at home with my mom at the time. She would have people from the congregation in the house. I was locked in my room like Rapunzel. She put food at my door thinking that would help. It's just this whole terrible situation. And worldwide, this is a part of their, this is a part of their doctrine. There are other things we can get into. I am a CSA survivor, and I speak about that as well. So part of my story involves the shunning, involves and the wake-up process. I think when you're in high-control religion, it's so different for every single individual. It's never, I don't want to say never, but it's rarely a one time, that's it, I'm out. It's usually a couple of steps. It's usually a wake-up process. That's why we call it a process. And for me, I think I was waking up for a couple of years. I just had that cognitive dissonance. Right. So the child sex abuse cases really, you think you're, there's this illusion of safety, right? You think that this won't happen to our group. This is, it couldn't. This is, we are going to live forever. Nobody else is. We're going to be on a paradise earth. The rest of the world is going to be destroyed. This can't happen in my group. Really? So I started listening to the Lee Remini, the Scientology documentary. I listened to other religions and what was going on in Scientology specifically. And I remember thinking to myself, that's just them. That's not Jehovah's Witnesses. That's them. They're a little weird. And it's actually the same. So I started waking up little by little, hearing more about CSA cases, because you're conditioned in this religion to not read anything outside organizational materials. Any defector, anyone who speaks negatively about it, they're liars. They're apostates. So you don't trust them. You don't believe them. But the interesting thing is, if you'd see a news article that spoke badly, or if there was an advocate speaking about the truth that was going on, or even telling their story, that's bad news. You're not supposed to listen to that. But if there's a news article that speaks highly of Jehovah's Witnesses, that's okay. That we're going to listen to that. So there was just so many things that just weren't adding up for me. But here I am now. I'm a wife. I'm a mother. My children are active. I have family. I have a whole life. I have decades of experiences. What am I going to do? Am I willing to lose all of it? And the answer was, yeah, I'm ready to start making a different life for my children and change that cycle of abuse. So that's, I tried to briefly combine.
Yeah. Wow. So it's very brave of you to have left that. And I think a lot of cult survivors, a lot of people from high control groups can relate to it. Often is a process. There is that moment where you actually have to make a decision of, am I going to keep going? Because in some respect, it's easier because I already have this community built. Or am I going to leave and know that everything is going to change for me? And that could be really scary. Was there a tipping point for you, or was it just an accumulation of the control, the abuse you'd experienced as a child? Was there like a tipping point, or was it just a cumulative effect that one day you're just like, I'm done?
For me, the tipping point was, and let me start out by saying, there are so many doctrinal, what they call truths in that religion that are so easily dismantled and debunked and disproved that even when I was in the religion, I couldn't prove some of the doctrine according to history, archaeology, or science. I couldn't prove them to be true. I was just told to believe it, and the answers were there before the questions. So what it took for me was to give myself permission to start Googling, to start reading other versions of the Bible, to start listening to other religions, not just people who left Jehovah's Witnesses. And the tipping point for me was when I discovered that the governing body, who are these eight men that are controlling the whole organization, I started seeing that at the time I was still very much a Christian, still very much a believer. But what was bothering me was my conscience was bothering me that I felt like they weren't giving enough credit to Jesus. And the governing body was getting all the credit. These are imperfect men who claim to not be inspired, but yet you still have to follow what they do. Well, if they're not inspired and the Bible says to not rely on our own understanding, whose understanding am I relying on then if they are the ones who are giving me all of this spiritual food, so to speak? And I thought, if they can rely on their own understanding, then I can rely on mine, right? But at the time, second guessing myself, pushing down my intuition. So really the tipping point was, this is not the truth. I don't know what is. I don't know how I'm going to find it, and I may never find it, but I know this is not it, because the truth stands up to scrutiny. If it's really the truth, if you're given evidence that this is or isn't the truth, and you still believe it, even though it's proven to not be the truth, then my belief was based on emotion. It was based on everything other than fact. And that was one of the things I had to go deep and discover. And to be honest with you, one of the greatest, most peaceful feelings was, I don't know. I'm okay not knowing. I was such a know-it-all in that religion. And I remember talking to people, Ashley, and just thinking to myself, boy, have I got answers for you. Rather than listening, just to understand them. I really wanted to change people. And so many things had changed for me after I realized this is not the truth. And so that was what was for me.
That makes so much sense. And it also reminds me a lot of bits in my story where it was just like this intellectual dishonesty. You just get to a point where you realize, like, I'm finding things that are objectively fact and they're not squaring what I've been told. And I've been told I always need to follow the truth. And then when you realize what you've been told is not the truth and you can prove that, it's very, it's confusing. But I think sometimes the downfall of these organizations and people leaving is that they do pound into your head, always follow the truth. Of course, they say they have the truth, but when you realize they don't, you still have that in the back of your head, follow the truth. And so then you start actually going after the facts. Wow. And in kind of the bio that I read, there was a mention of intense mind control and indoctrination. And I think to some people, those words can sound really big and they can sound like, what does that even mean? I know that there's conspiracy theories out there about how our minds can be controlled by the water we drink. There's all those kinds of things. And so we're not talking about that. But in a high control group, in a cult-like group, what does indoctrination, what does mind control actually look like practically? And how did that affect you?
Great question. For me, indoctrination, I can boil it down to one word, and that's fear. If I would come to a conclusion, which I was afraid to think outside the box, I was afraid to think critically. Thinking critically really is you're given a bunch of data, whether it's opinions or facts, or you're given data. And you formulate your own thought process through this data. And you're going to hold true to that, right? That's where every day our brains are processing information and we make decisions based on that information that we have. In high control religion, mind control is based on fear. There's always a consequence of something, right? So if I were to Google Jehovah's Witnesses, even in my generation, I'm 42. My generation is just on the cusp of before technology. So I'm hopeful for the younger generation, but we weren't allowed to Google Jehovah's Witnesses. You're programmed to think before you even do it. Indoctrination looks like, if I do this, there's a consequence. That's not the everyday consequences. If I don't put my seatbelt on, there's a chance I can get hurt in an auto accident. Yes, there are consequences every day that don't involve mind control. But for high control religion, in my experience, it's not listening to my inner voice, where the inner critic is louder. It's not listening to my intuition about a person or a situation or a circumstance. It's, I have to be here. It's obligation. It's the fog, right? Fear, obligation, and guilt. And that's what indoctrination looked like. It's the emotional control. It's based on the BITE model. And I don't know if your audience is familiar with the BITE model, but if they
aren't. Yeah, but say it again. We've talked about it before, but it's worth saying again. Yeah.
Stephen Hassan is a cult expert and he's a PhD and he wrote an amazing book that talks about mind control and religions. And it's the BITE model is behavior, information, thought, and emotion control. And once it's defined and once you read about it, this can also apply to relationships. This can apply just in everyday situations. So behavior, right? We were dressing a certain way and talking a certain way and using the same language. And Jehovah's Witnesses, they called it the pure language. It was this universal language. No, it's loaded language. That's what it is. They create wonderful words and just completely redefine them. For example, Jehovah's Witnesses call it the truth, which means there's only one truth. Anything else is false. That's indoctrination. Words that they use indoctrinate us and control our minds as well. It's a very broad topic, hard to condense, but that was my experience in a nutshell.
Wow. Wow. That's helpful to know. And can you say the FOG acronym again and go through that real quickly? Because that would help.
Is fear, obligation, and guilt. And that is very much linked and tied to narcissistic abuse. Narcissistic abuse is also a byproduct. Being a survivor is also a byproduct of high control religion. And one of the things that really helped me was I was in counseling, being the daughter of a narcissist. I didn't put the two together. So my counselor, who I'll mention him if I can, Dr. Ryan Lee, he is a cult expert psychologist. He is a former JW. And when we talked about narcissism, once you learn it, you can't unlearn it. So you have fear of displeasing this person or this group. You have an obligation to do everything you can to make this person happy or else. And the guilt comes from everything you do, you're under compulsion to do things right, to behave, to obey. And when you do those things, there's a consequence of good. So they have the abuse reward cycle, right? The abuse reward cycle or the behavior reward cycle. And so if you do this, particular, if you behave this way, you're going to get rewarded with a privilege in the congregation. But we determine the criteria. And if you do something and step out of line, which we'll let you know what that is, you're going to lose that privilege. If you lose that privilege, you can always get it back. We're going to tell you when and how you're going to get it back if you stay in line. So you have this constant fear and this obligation and this guilt, and it's a vicious cycle. So in learning about narcissistic abuse, that is exactly what I did, was I looked at the religion as a person, as a toxic relationship. And I tried very hard to not, so I don't want to stereotype or generalize. For Jehovah's Witnesses specifically, and just in many of the survivors that I had spoken to, there is an astonishing trend that I saw where the women were more attached emotionally to the resurrection hope, which Jehovah's Witnesses, if any of you are familiar with the doctrine, they say that there's a split group, right? There are certain groups who are going to live forever in paradise first, and then there's another group that they're going to go to heaven. And you know which group you are, you're in. But the women were attached to that hope. The men were attached. It's astonishing that men, and I know this sounds generalizing, so I apologize if this doesn't describe, if you're listening and this doesn't describe you, but a lot of the men that I speak with, they were more attached to the doctrine. The emotional control was mostly friends and family. Sometimes their careers or their livelihood was wrapped up in the religion. But for the most part, the doctrine has kept a lot of the men, because the doctrine is what gives these men the privileges. Women don't have privileges. Women preach. Women nurture. Women are the wives and the mothers. The men are the leaders, and they need to know the doctrine to be these leaders.
Wow.
So we had this amazing difference here of what you need to let go of in order to finally step into who you really are, which we're continually learning how to do that. Yeah.
That's really helpful to understand. And I think those acronyms are helpful. I also, from some of the studies that I've seen, I think it was like medical doctors and pastor or religious leaders have higher numbers of narcissistic. They draw higher numbers of narcissistic people because of the power. And that's not to say all doctors or all pastors, so don't at me, guys, but they are power structures. And I think it can both groom people to be narcissistic that way, but it can also attract people who already have those tendencies. And then they create a whole system out of that. So that's really helpful. And my next question was really going to be about how women are specifically treated in these movements. And then you already started to touch on that. I think it's helpful in what you said to note that women in the movement tend to be more pulled in by this hope of something better, maybe because it's really sucky being a woman in the religion. And then men are often drawn to it because of the power structure that it gives them and the privilege. What are some other things that people should know about the group you were in and how women were treated?
Woman who speaks out is rebellious. A woman does not lead. A woman does not go ahead of the man, whether it's her husband, could be her minor son who is baptized. He's now in charge of her, even if it's
wow,
big time.
So a child, as long as he is baptized, he has more authority over his mother?
Yep. Especially in the congregation. So say there's what Jehovah's Witnesses do is they go preaching and it's very organized. So say 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning, you meet at the Kingdom Hall. That's what the buildings are called. You meet at the Kingdom Hall. And that's when they go door to door. And it's called leading the group. So a man or a baptized male will read a passage and take everybody out. Women do not do that unless there has to be no men in the building in order for a woman to lead the group. So if you have an underage child, as long as they're baptized, they're in charge of that whole group. And they're grooming young men, young children from a very small age to get baptized for this reason. Two things. It encourages and it's empowering. But like I said earlier, it's the illusion of knowledge. It's the illusion of empowerment. And it also is starting, it gives people this savior complex. We have to see them because we have the truth. That savior complex follows people outside the organization. That was something I had to unravel too. There's nothing wrong with wanting to help people, but there's this component that's really important where people can help and save themselves. That's what was missing in that religion. So yes, women, they give talks and they have videos on a woman's place. So we know purity culture is a big issue. We're responsible for the thoughts of men. We're responsible for the thoughts of women. If I'm 5'8", right? So I'm tall and I say this now, but I didn't always. I love my body. I love my shape, but I wouldn't wear potato sacks to sermons because I was so afraid to draw attention to myself because that is very much a negative thing. Just the way that I walked, I was taught class and elegance. And even if I walked with my shoulders back, that would raise eyebrows. Confidence, not something that looks good on a woman in that organization. There were a couple times where repeatedly I had leadership mentioning to me that I need to tone it down a little bit, that I'm a little too much yet not enough. And you're groomed to be wives. But that's your only goal. Your only aspiration is to be a wife and be a mother. That's why we see so many people getting married so young. And divorces are on the rise as well. Because there's no sex before marriage. And outside of religion, that's a personal decision. But there's no sex before marriage. And you have no other aspiration. So when you're married, that's when the fun begins, right? That's the illusion. You are now considered mature. You get invited to all the parties. You're looked at as an example. And so when I was little, I had this conflicting feeling, Ashley. I wanted to be a journalist. I wanted to be on camera. I was a very passionate, artistic person, but you're not allowed to go to college. You're not allowed to do anything unless you're strictly preaching, teaching, and working in the congregation. And that's the outlook for a lot of women. So they get married to get out of their house. And it's a really big struggle.
I'm just looking at this from so many angles. And it's really interesting because in some of my experiences, like women were not allowed to preach and teach. And so it's interesting how they had somewhat of a structure where that was allowed, but it was still under the authority of men. And so it still had to be sanctioned that way. So it's really not freer because you're saying the things that you're told to say. And then I'm also thinking of how that must be not only difficult for adult women, but for girls to see their brothers being given places of honor and authority that they had not earned, maybe were not as competent at. But then also to think of the little boys who are forced into positions at a young age to take leadership over adults that they're not developmentally capable of. And so even pressing people into gender roles on kind of both sides there. It's just such a toxic thing.
It is about how it looks. There are so many men in that organization who don't want to get on the platform and give a talk. There are so many men who don't want to speak before the public. And that's okay. But in that organization, that's what makes a man look spiritual. If he's not doing these things, if he's not speaking out, if he's not giving talks and climbing the ladder to get these positions of leadership, then he's not a reputable spiritual man. Mm-hmm. That's what men are conditioned to think, that your self-worth is wrapped up in your position, your title. And we see that even outside religion. People have their identity wrapped up in what they are, not who they are. And in religion, you're not taught to develop that who part. And so it's very disorienting when you leave.
And that's what I want to get into next. I want to talk about you understanding your value as an individual person and overcoming all that indoctrination. But I have a curious question first. And this is coming from somebody who grew up independent fundamentalist Baptist. We did not think a lot of other groups were actually Christian. We did not think Catholics were Christian. We did not think Mormons were Christian. We did not think Jehovah's Witnesses were Christian. Is that similar with your group? Yeah. Did you think the others were not Christian?
No, the JWs would call themselves true Christians. If you read in their literature, and I could send you screenshots up till recently, they say true Christians, but they're referring to themselves in third person. So yeah, nobody else was Christian, just Jehovah's Witnesses.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of the things that you can note very quickly about high control groups is we are the only ones who actually know what we're doing out of all the thousands and thousands of years and hundreds of different theological perspectives. We have found the one true way and everybody else.
You know, I may just add this. So I recently went to a conference. It's called the Edison Awards here in Fort Myers. And I had this amazing opportunity to be around these brilliant inventors and these big thinkers. And it's biotechnology. So they're on the cutting edge of technology and advancing healthcare and advancing, like, for example, there was a treadmill for humans who are in wheelchairs and they can advance their cardiology health. And it was just so fascinating. I say this because I'm in my body now and I'm so inspired by these brilliant brains, not thinking at all about what they believe as far as religion goes. My former self, she would have thought, it's a shame, they're all going to die and they're all going to be destroyed. These are the things that we would think. It doesn't matter the good that they're doing or the things they're overturning or the way they're trying to heal people or the planet. No, it's because they're not Jehovah's Witnesses. They just don't matter. And that's something I was really excited to unravel.
Such a deeper concept, because so many times these high control groups, they view themselves as being the arbitrators of morality. What is moral? What's not moral? And I know from experience myself that there can be teachings around, like, people outside of this group. They're not happy. They're sad. They really don't feel like they have meaning or purpose in their life. And, oh yeah, they're going to be destroyed one day. And then when you step out of the group and you realize, oh, wow, I actually feel happier outside of it. I'm not sad all the time. Everybody has sad emotions and happy emotions.
We can't be sad or negative, because that has a really bad look about your belief system.
And just taking on human emotions as reflecting on your entire group and having to suppress certain feelings because you're not showing the perfect way of the true church. And
And even if you mistrust someone, or if even something as simple as forming normal everyday relationships. And I didn't know what it was until I, in talking with other people and tons of counseling, what goes on the outside. See, that was the thing. I didn't have the contrast. So I didn't know, how do people find friends? How do people form relationships? See, in the high control groups, you're told these are the people you're going to be spending the rest of your life with. These are your, out of two or three people, you pick and choose who you're going to date, who you're going to spend time with. Outside of that control group, people make relationships every day, whether it's at school or just in passing. You can pick and choose who's a good influence on you. These are the things you can choose on your own as you develop. In high control religion, you don't have that option. You do not associate with people who do not adhere to the same ideology. And that is very dangerous. It put us in an echo chamber. Mm-hmm. It's this false sense of safety. When you're with people who only believe and echo what you believe, there is no growth there. So they didn't want to hear my opinions. They wanted to hear their opinions coming out of my mouth. And that is for 8 million people around the world. And you think that everybody knows, right? You think everybody knows Jehovah's Witnesses. Everybody's against us. The government is out to get us, Jehovah's Witnesses. But nobody cares. Not out to get us. Nobody even knows what's going on that on the inside of that.
The persecution complex is strong.
Yeah.
Us against them. Ooh, yeah. So what was it like to start to realize and see yourself as a valuable individual who, outside of the group, was able to have your own moral compass, your own intuition, your own friendships? How did you overcome the feelings of unworthiness you've been indoctrinated with and really come into a place of life where, like, you're standing on your own 2 feet as an individual who feels self-empowered?
I feel for me, that is going to be a lifelong work, something I'm working on. Developing my self-worth, I really want to attribute it to my kids as they were becoming teenagers. I'll give you an example. So I went through this state of just feeling very sad and very depressed. And when you leave and realize your whole life is a lie, there is this grieving or this intense grieving process. And you think you're okay for a while, and then it'll hit you again. It hits you in waves, right? Because as we all know, grief is not linear. There's no time period for it. And my physical appearance, I just wasn't taking care of myself. And my daughter, who was otherwise very into getting dressed up, and at the time, she just loves that kind of stuff. And she was mimicking me. She wasn't taking care of herself. She was just not really washing her hair. And I noticed I need to make a change here. So for me, my self-worth was wrapped up in what I am, not who I am. And honestly, figuring that out, it took a lot of going. When I first woke up, I deleted social media entirely. I needed to just focus on myself. And at the time I woke up, when I say woke up, it was a process, but I literally said no more right around 2020. And at that time, there was such political and civil unrest and social unrest all over social media. And I was like, my mentality my whole life was, I don't know what to think of me. What do you think of me? And the question really, Wendy, what do you think of you? But I had no one to set that north for me. I had no one to say, listen, you're going to question yourself. This is the stuff I should have wondered maybe when I was an early adolescent. So what does that look like for me? I read a lot. And I ask myself, is this what I believe, or is this indoctrination, or is this me? I was helped to appreciate if anxiety comes back up. Is this indoctrination coming back up, or is this something that I am really afraid of? So I go very slowly about life. I pause. I don't make very quick decisions. I analyze and I ask myself elementary school questions. Is it right? Is it accurate? Is it helpful? All those things we teach our kids to ask. I'm relearning how to critically think. And if I'm being even more honest, I don't know that I'm ever going to have it all figured out, but I'm okay with that. I'm okay with being wrong. And I talk to people from different walks of life with intention because I want to learn. I feel like I got a late start in life. And I think a lot of us feel that way in my 40s. And I feel like this brain would have been so much more useful 20 years ago. But I fell in love with life. And then when that comes back up, like right now, I'm in this really cool phase where 40 something year old me goes to hang out with 12 year old me. And she says things to her like, ew, I remember that. That was a win. You didn't know it then, but that was a win. And I'll look at her and I'll think of her. And then when something bad happens, I'll think, ew, you deserved a lot better in that moment. I promise you, it's going to be okay. Promise you right now, this seems hard. And then I tap into future me, like Wendy in her 50s. And I think, I know we get there, but how do we get there? and I tap into her wisdom. I do that by spending time with intention around people who have completely different outlooks on life than I do. And I think to myself, is that something I can adhere to? Show me the proof. If it's, there's no proof, then I am always second guessing it. Yeah. That was a very scenic route.
Now, that's so powerful. And I love, that's a practical tool I think people can take with them, is looking back at their younger selves and applauding them for wins, comforting our younger selves for things that shouldn't have happened, and then looking towards the future and what wisdom we can pull from that. That's so beautiful.
And then one of my quotes is, because I don't have anyone from my past. Fortunately, my father was never in the religion. So I do have my father, but he's caught in the middle of my siblings and myself. My older brother is not in, but I shunned him for 25 years and I'm feeling the consequences of that. He's not in my life anymore. And even though I apologized when I woke up for that behavior that I participated in with a lot of other people that I love very dearly, it's still a wound and I have to live in that. And I forgive myself for it, but there are so many things that I have to accept are a byproduct of indoctrination, the decisions that I made. At some point, yes, I can say I was indoctrinated when I made that choice, but I still made that choice. So forgiveness of yourself for the choices we made in that religion is something I really needed to work on, because that's also where the guilt is. When you wake up, there's comfort in staying in the group, right? There's comfort because you justify it and you think you're doing it right. And when you leave, like, oh man, I was the most judgmental, not empathetic person ever. And now I made phone calls and I thought of everybody I could talk to. I'm so sorry that I hurt you when I was on the inside. And there was healing there.
And that's so beautiful, because there was the accountability and the taking on of, I did this thing that hurt you. And also at the same time, there was a reason behind it and I can begin forgiving myself. And just that dual releasing of shame and also doing your best to right things, I think that's really beautiful and shows growth and just a way forward for other people. One thing I wanted to ask you at the beginning of this question, you said something to the effect of, people were telling me who I was and I had to figure out what I am. And I'm wondering, what are you, Wendy?
Great question.
As you look at yourself.
I am a mom. I am someone who, that's my contribution to the future, is being a mom of two wonderful kids. I am the person who wants to understand you. I am the person who, by your story, by whatever it is you've been through, whoever you are, I want to grow. I want to do better. I can only do better tomorrow and be an active member of an ever-changing world by truly wanting to learn from people. And people told me who I was because I had no compass. I was never taught boundaries. I was never taught, this person may not have a positive influence on me, but just because they're a JW, I could still be around these creepy people, right? And that was the story. If they believe what I believe, I could still be around them. And I was exposed to very abusive people. So now, who am I? Is I am just another person trying to make it, trying to land on my two feet. And every day I want to be better than I was yesterday, but not in the way where I feel obligated or guilty if I'm not. I just want to keep on trying to be a good person. That does not look like trying to change other people or trying to make other people's beliefs mine. That looks like, I'm here for you. I'm going to sit in this with you and I'm going to help you. And that's what helps me when I'm lacking something, or when I need a hug, or when I miss my friends, I reach out to other people and see if they need a hug or if they need friends. And somehow I think that is what helps me move forward.
I have one last question for you. This is what we ask all of our guests. And that is, what does courage mean to you?
Not afraid of being wrong. There is an opportunity in being incorrect. And I look for those opportunities. If I'm looking to grow, I'm not going to grow if I'm right all the time. That was a lot for me to unravel. When you're told something is the truth, when you're told a lie is the truth for your entire life and you realize it was all a lie, you start to think everything's a lie. And now everybody's toxic and everybody's a narcissist. I went through that phase too. Well, courage to me means just be okay with being wrong. Be okay with not having the answers. Be okay with not knowing. Because when something is true to you, when something means something, or when anything could be a fact, it could be a person, you'll know. But for me, when I don't know what to do, I do nothing. I pause. I hope that answers your question. It was really hard for me to just say, I don't know. And I may be wrong. And I'm okay with that.
That is so important. I think sometimes people dig in their heels when they are confronted with new information that could correct their ideas. But as you said, the way we learn and grow is being confronted by new information and allowing ourselves to grow through that. That's really beautiful. And I really love this interview. It's been great. And I know other people are going to want to tune in and follow the other things that you do. So where can people find you?
You can find me on Instagram. My handle is Wendy Renee. I'm sure you'll drop that in the description box. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you work it. I am on TikTok, not that often. I've actually slowed down in a lot of my content creation and focusing on my family and focusing on my emotional health. Something's going to give, so I don't have the bandwidth to do everything. You can also find me on YouTube. I do interviews as well, and I really just want people to be okay. I really do. I want them to know that there is life on the other side of control. There is. And we just don't see it when we're on that inside. Like you said earlier, you're taught that when you leave, life falls apart. You're taught that you're going to be unhealthy and you're going to fall into these patterns that are destructive. And that's not the case at all. I drink loose leaf tea and I read Psychology Today and I do meditations, and I never thought I would see that side, the positive side of leaving high control relationships and groups. And I really hope who's ever watching this, that they know that they can do it. There is peace out there.
That's so powerful. Thank you, Wendy. Wow. We needed to hear that. And everybody, after you're done following Wendy's social media, and please do that, you're going to want to check out her work. She's done some really amazing things. Also, make sure you check out Courage365 on all our social media spaces. We have Instagram, Twitter, we've got YouTube, Facebook, TikTok, all the different places you can find us. And of course, you can go to our website, courage365.org, where you can find a need help tab if you're in a crisis situation with all kinds of resources. We also have a free resource section where there are ebooks and courage cards and all kinds of cool trainings that have been created just for you. But my favorite resource that I want to share for you all is our text message list. So this is a text message list created by survivors for survivors. We don't spam you. You don't get messages from other survivors. It's simply an encouraging, empowering text message every morning, Monday through Friday, that can really just give you that shot in the arm of courage that you need to start your day. And all you have to do to join that is text the word courage to 917-809-7311. And when you text that number with the word courage, you'll automatically be added to the list. We've had so many people talk about how this has really changed their lives and given them the courage they needed to move forward. Thank you all so much for tuning in. And as always, live with courage.